covered her small breasts. He'd never seen her stomach before. The movement of the dripping water caught the light, making the soft, flat plane of muscle look like glass. Her hair, normally floating around her face in fuzzy tendrils, lay flat against her skull, shining and damp, tamed in the elastic band at the back of her neck. When she slid into the booth across from him, he saw she still had mud beneath her transparent fingernails and a smudge of dirt beneath her chin. Around them, the Urfers were laughing, slapping their crews' backs and chattering words the Didetto couldn't understand, but they laughed along anyway. The spirit under the awning was light, if slightly bewildered. Crews hauled boards and tarps out onto the worksite to cover the worst of the mud pits, marveling at the grace with which the long-legged aliens navigated the slippery terrain. The black-clad official crews hung back, not quite willing to soil their expensive uniforms, but the original work crews made do as best they could. Soon everyone was getting back into the routine of their work except Meg and Lul. She pushed aside a ring of cable and carefully packed the heavy lenses within the ring. Lul stared at her, not helping, not moving, watching her face and catching the guarded glances she threw his way now and then. She took longer than necessary to clear the spot in front of them, her face still and lowered. Then she folded her hands in front of her, her long fingers interlacing with that ease that still sent a thrill through him. "Lul." She spoke loudly enough to hear her without the earpiece. She used her own voice, not activating the translation comm. The word sounded like wind through the water reeds when she said it, and he wished she'd turn on the comms. He even pointed to her wrist screen. He didn't want to fall under her spell again. He wondered if she really could use some kind of magic to enthrall him. Right now, after the rain, after the lie, he wanted to see her with some sort of detachment, some sort of prejudice that he hadn't seen her with yet. He didn't want to lean in to catch the bell-like sound of her voice, or watch the way the light played pink and orange on her skin, picking up the small brown flecks that broke up the smooth surface, visible only when he sat very close to her. He wanted to see her with different eyes. He wanted to see her the other way she was, tall and pale and flimsy and weird. Alien. If it turned out the secret she kept from him was dangerous, he wanted to have the thoughts in place to protect himself. She pulled the screen out, laying it flat against the table. A few jabs at the symbols and he could hear her in his ear once again. She didn't say anything, but he could hear her breath when she sighed and the brush of the towel as she squeezed water from the rope of hair that hung down her neck. "Lul," she said, still in her own voice. It was the only word she could say in his language. His own voice took over her words.
"Meg. Need want."
She didn't finish the sentence, even though he saw her mouth moving. Before the earpiece, he would have thought she was talking in that silent way. Instead, it looked like she was trying on words but couldn't find one to come out. He knew how she felt.
"Meg."
He looked at the screen, wishing he could read it, wishing she had designed it so he too could pick out words amid the red blocks of symbols.
"Lul need want talk. Lul give word to Meg. Trust. Yes?"
He heard her swallow and saw the muscles in her thin neck move. "Yes."
"Trust is ask question and talk answer. Answer is good okay, not bad no good. This is trust, yes?"
He finally lifted his gaze to meet hers. Maybe it was the light filtering through the post-rain haze, but her eyes seemed shinier than usual, almost brilliant.
"Trust is Lul need want answer. Meg has answer. Meg talks. Yes."
"Yes."
"Lul need want answer. Meg talk?"
He stared at her, waiting.
"No."
When she still said nothing, he looked back at the screen.
"Meg show Lul word trust here. Where is Trust?
Meg pointed to a slim red box near the bottom right corner. Lul made the settling stance, making sure she saw him. He placed his hand on the box for Trust. Being sure she followed his hands, he pressed it again and then slowly and deliberately moved his hand to a button he knew and pressed.
No.
Meg. Meg covered her face with her hands, blinking hard to keep the tears from spilling out over her lashes. She didn't need the language screen to know what Lul was saying. She could see it on his face, in his eyes, the way his third lid kept creeping into sight as if it could protect him from the pain she knew she was causing him. She didn't know exactly what happened at that press conference, but the translator had picked up enough to give her a pretty good idea. The Didetto wanted to know if there were more Earthers coming. It seemed like the reporter who'd been dragged out of the press conference had been demanding an answer to that. Batto had given a reply that the translator was still working on, but the gist of it seemed to be that the people in charge had come to their own conclusions about the answer. Whatever that conclusion was, it made Lul unhappy and tense. She could hear it in the thrum of his throat. Even worse, she could hear the change in that pitch when he looked at her, when he had asked her directly, more directly than he had asked her anything up to this point, and she had pretended not to understand. Now her newest word, trust, was being used to let her know that he was on to her. He knew she was lying, and she could only imagine the nightmares he was dreaming up to explain the lie. Of course, she couldn't use those words, could she? Did they dream? They didn't sleep, but when they dropped, did they dream? Would they even know what nightmares were? For one stupid moment, she actually considered resettling and starting to broach that topic. Stupid, she knew, because if they didn't get across this hurdle, they might as well bring in Batto to do the translating. The bond was straining between them, and it was her fault. But how could she tell him? How do you explain to people who have never seen the blackness of space, who have never left the gravity of their own world and thrown themselves into the upside-down reality of interstellar travel, that some things were just not spoken of? If it had taken this long to learn the word for trust, how long would it take to teach the word for superstition? Because that's what it was, a superstition, and they all knew it. But when you stake your life on the stability of an improbable and unstable propulsion system to catapult yourself beyond the known edges of your universe, because you're following the ancient message of strangers who might be your ancestors, you didn't have to be a psychologist to see why people clung to small comforts and less than logical assurances. It was one of the oddest reasons Meg felt at home among deep space travelers. In the beginning of her career, she had stuck to the inner colonies, those stops within the terraforming ring that were reached with traditional transport ships. The voyages took weeks or even months, but the ships were well-appointed and safety records so unbroken nobody even bothered to consider the dangers. But as her career had progressed and her reputation had grown, she'd been compelled to strike out farther, to the outer colonies and the experimental stations where international and cultural tensions ran high. Her first trip to what was then the deepest of the deep space stations, Excelsior, had made her so nervous that she'd been tranquilized to the point of stupidity by the ship's med team. She remembered trying to sneak in a lucky nickel her grandmother had given her as a child, terrified the security team would find it and strip it from her. As carefully as they had scanned her bags and body for unnecessary and dangerous metals and weights before departure, she'd been stunned when she'd gotten to her cubby and found the nickel in the pocket where she'd left it. Of course she couldn't hold it during deep sleep, but when she'd come out of stasis, the first thing she did was pull that nickel out and squeeze it, thanking it for her safe arrival. That first trip was where she saw how deep space travelers really worked. The men and women on these crews were the bravest of the sailors, the biggest risk-takers, the most prepared for any type of emergency. They were the innovators, the pioneers, the Magellans of space travel. These pilots made enormous amounts of money they never spent on anything except more travel, their timeline so out of sync with their planet-bound families and friends that they tended to seek out only each other for company. As her job took her farther and farther into the reaches of human space, she came to feel at home among the deep spacers. Not because she had even a fraction of their knowledge of physics or engineering or navigational computation, but because when all the computations had been completed and the limitations of physics were under control, she saw these men and women pull out their pendants and their fetishes and their touchstones and keepsakes and prayer cards. Jefferson carried the three stone fetishes that the Galen miners carried as protection against danger. Prater, she knew, always wore a piece of red silk somewhere on her body, going so far as to weave it around the edge of her sleep sack during stasis. Wagner had a small ebony box, the contents of which were unknown to anyone else on board. Cho had a series of tattooed symbols scattered across his body, adding to them with every deep space trip he made. He never told her the meanings of them, but she would catch him touching one or the other as different problems arose on voyages. He would even place her hands on some of them when they made love, the sight of her hand on his markings moving him in ways she never asked him to explain. And she, of course, wore the dented brass locket she told anyone who asked was broken and could not be opened. All the deep space crews she'd worked with knew that was a lie, and to date none had called her on it. How could she tell this to Lul? How could she reconcile the technology the Didetto found so intriguing, so revolutionary, with the inexplicable need to cling to talismans and charms? They had propelled themselves through billions of miles of empty space using a recombinant crystal that in all probability should have blown them to stardust months before. They had Earther medical advances that clearly outstripped the Didetto by decades, if not centuries. So how could it be that not one of the five crew members could bring themselves to answer the simple question of whether or not more of their kind were coming? That answer was that no Earther who had ever ventured past the first ring of terraforming would ever, even under pain of death, break the immutable law of the dark side. When the first voyagers had gone out, before the terraforming ring had even been imagined, it was common practice for shuttles, really just primitive ejection pods at the time, to be dropped onto surfaces while the main ship remained in orbit around the body. Communication with those on the surface was often broken up by radiation and the distance from surface to ship. The main ship would go dark side, go to the other side of the space body, leaving those on the surface cut off, alone. In those early years, more people didn't survive the missions than did, and those that did let it be known that while the main ship was on the dark side, it was never to be mentioned. Psychologically, it proved too easy for the isolation and possibility of being stranded to break even the most vetted astronauts, and more than one surface walker had cracked the helmet, taking his or her own life rather than face the terror of the main ship not returning. And so, decades later and billions of miles deeper into space, that psychological safeguard had taken on the profundity of scripture. When you are on the surface and your ship was dark side, nobody uttered a word of its absence. The names of the absent crew members were as good as forgotten, and no deep space traveler would ever consider breaking this code for any reason. Meg hadn't realized how deeply ingrained this understanding was in her and the rest of the crew. It had never been tested. People in the deep space colonies knew the law as well as any traveler to their port, and thus nobody ever demanded the rule be broken. Now, all the understood rules of Earthers and the colonies and the terraforming rings were gone. Nothing could be assumed anymore, and the five of them were facing a breakdown in communication that could jeopardize all of their lives because Meg couldn't be certain that even thinking the name of the woman remaining in the ship outside the Didet atmosphere wouldn't bring catastrophe upon all of them. Part of her screamed that it was stupid. It was a superstition. Nothing she could say or do could in any way affect the fate of the Damocles. The capricious crystal worked on its own logic, and it certainly wouldn't be words that made it malfunction, especially words spoken thousands of miles away on the surface of a planet. But staring into the gray, three-lidded eyes of this stranger from another life stream so different from her own and yet so similar, logic didn't hold much sway. She couldn't even ask Cho or the other crew members what she should do. It was that thing that would not be spoken of, period. Until that person who could not be named made contact, the terror of Darkseid held them all in its grip. She wondered if she should try to teach Lul the word for crazy, because that's how she felt. Crazy and helpless to fight it. Unwilling to fight it. But that didn't mean she had to let it tear apart her bond with Lul. She took his hand in both of hers. He started to pull it away, but she wrapped her fingers around his thick wrist. They both knew he was more than strong enough to break her grasp, and she felt heartened that he didn't. He didn't cling to her hand, though. He just let her hold it. Lul. Pulling one hand free, she moved over the screen. Trust Meg. He moved his free hand over the screen, but she pushed it away, pushing one button repeatedly. Need want, need want, need want. She spoke again. Trust Meg.
Meg talk Lul. Questions. Questions Meg talk Lul.
Biting her lip in frustration, Meg pressed Lul's hands down through the light screen, holding them against the table, and stared at the language prompts illuminating their intermingled hands. She flicked off the screen and brought her hands together between his. Maybe she could tell him without telling him. Cupping her hands as he had earlier, she looked at him as she spoke. Meg no talk. Meg no questions. She heard his teeth grind together and then stop as she put her hands outside of his, still curved as if cupping a much larger bowl. Later, Meg talk. Lul ask. Meg answer. He stared at her hands, the pitch of his thumb dropping in intensity. When he spoke, she could see he didn't use the broken half-language they'd been using. He spoke in his real language, not bothering or maybe not able to think in the half-speak they'd built. Meg activated the screen once more and saw the program filtering through his words, recognizing several that had come up in their discussions of food and water. When she saw the translator put together the meaning of his question, she leaned forward, pressing her forehead to his clenched fists. Yes, Lul, yes. Didet is safe. Didet is safe. Earthers are no danger. He pulled back his hands, and she sat up, her shoulders slumped. She suddenly felt exhausted, the cuts and scrapes and bruises of their mud fights making themselves known all over her body. She wanted to sleep and not dream for about a month or two. Mostly she wanted Lul to believe her and free her of this burden of secrecy. He gripped the sides of the table, staring at the light screen, then glancing up at her. He looked at the ship and the crews and the archiving cameras. He looked at Mamu's lenses and the line of wet clothes Jefferson had hung out to dry. His thrum went silent for several long seconds, and Meg thought she might scream if he didn't give her his answer soon. Finally, his thrum returned, low and steady. His hand hovered over the light screen, but he put it back down, choosing instead to look up at her, his inner eyelid back out of sight. He considered her a moment and then spoke.
Yes. Lul trust Meg. Okay.
Chapter 12. Lul. What could he do? It was like in the game Circle when you drew that dual block and you had no arsenal. All you could do was go all in, put all your magic in the pot and in the hold of the great sail and hope you made it across. Hark hated it when Lul used that strategy. He told him it was the same as cheating, that it wasn't a strategy at all, but the kind of stupid blundering that ruined the game for everyone. He usually said these things because he was angry that 9 out of 10 times the strategy worked for Lul and he wound up on the Mountain of Power before anyone else. What could he do? He was the kind of guy who, when face to face with an alien species that he knew was lying to him, thought about a kid's game he was too old to still be playing. Meg's face took on yet another new expression. It seemed the long, bony planes of their faces had no end to the permutations they could bend into. She folded up her body, too, bringing her skinny knees up to her chest, somehow wedging them in between her chest and the table, wrapping her arms around them and resting her chin where her forearms piled up. She looked small enough to shoot through a palm cannon, and he noticed that the thickness of both her forearms pressed together still didn't match the thickness of one of his. Her fingers draped like fringe over the bend of her arms. He just looked at her and let her watch him. Everything was different now. The official crews, those black-clad work teams the Urfers had refused to acknowledge. Lul knew the truth about them now. All his life he'd watched the official crews working at accident sites, fires, science labs, anywhere the news crews were. The black-clad crews worked with that quick, crisp efficiency he and everyone around him so admired. Videos of those professionals had been shown in schools to encourage all of them to work harder, study harder, strive to be better. He'd even dreamed, way back in the day when he'd written his special alien invasion preparation report for the Telemetry Administration, of being a member of one of those crews, of donning an expensive black overshirt and manning the extra atmosphere satellite control. Now he saw how they really worked. Maybe this site was an exception, but Lul doubted it. Lul doubted everything now. What happened here probably happened everywhere, every day, every time the news crews reported from a site. There were probably hundreds of work teams all over the world just doing their job every day, showing up, getting it done until, for whatever reason, what they were doing became newsworthy, and just like that, the official crews moved into place. Cameras got footage of handsome, well-dressed men and women with shiny equipment and determined, serious faces. And why? Because people like him and Kik and Olam didn't come across as handsome on television? Because Effin, too, had a tendency to spit when she got excited? Would it so traumatize the people of Kartar to see that the geologist working with the Urfer Chefsin was missing two side teeth and had a tendency to huff his solvents before he dropped? Lul knew he was working himself into a solid sulk, and that he'd been sitting there far longer than was normal or proper, not saying a word to Meg. It didn't seem to faze her. She just watched him, curled up into herself in that impossibly flimsy way that he knew he was helpless to not be fascinated by. He knew he'd always give in to the fascination. He'd always let his mouth drop open in wonder, and he'd always choose the course of stupid curiosity over practical safety. That was probably one of the reasons the official crews replaced people like him. Okay, he was definitely in a sulk now. He didn't know how to get himself out of it. In time, he figured he and Meg would get back to talking, muddle through the awkwardness until something resembling the old rhythm would fall into place. He wanted to get to that place now. He wanted to skip this part and get to the part where it would be easy again. He wanted to go home, and he wanted to talk to Hark and Poe. He wanted a hot meal. He wanted to be back in that place where he didn't have to think so hard about how things worked. He just wanted. And he wanted to be able to say this to Meg, but he had no idea how to start. Lul. Her eyes were wide and strange-looking, stranger-looking than usual. They bent down in the far corners in a way he hadn't seen before, and the fine line of hair over them bent in a graceful upward curve. Lul. She didn't say his name as a question, and she didn't say anything else. She just untangled her arms and legs from their tight knot, putting her feet down and resting her hands lightly, as always, on the table for just a moment. Then he couldn't see exactly how she did it, but she seemed to somehow ripple her spine, bending in a fluid curve until she flowed like oil beneath the table. He could only stare, watching the empty space where her head had been and jumping in surprise when her head popped up at his side of the table. She reversed her weird ripple, lifting and bending herself until she folded into the seat beside him. He didn't say anything, couldn't say anything, surprise robbing him of words. It was harder to see her without turning his body all the way around since she tucked herself in slightly behind him in the booth. She slid closer until the thin line of her legs pressed against his, her pale bare shoulder nudging the thin cloth of his work shirt. He thought at first she was pushing him to move, but the pressure was so light he hardly had to resist it. Even folded up as she was, her body was still longer than his, and the ridge of her shoulder carriage rested above his. She bent forward, folding one leg sideways, draping the other over it, her hands puddling up in the space between her thin thighs, and she brought her face close to his.
This is okay? Lul okay, Meg here?
He didn't know if he was okay or not. He'd been close to Meg before. They'd touched and walked together, brushing up against each other as the Urfers did when they walked, but this was different. Meg was different. Hell, he was different. Her skin looked bumpy when her arm brushed against his shirt sleeve, the fine hairs standing on end across her pale skin. He could feel her vibrate as she leaned into him.
Cold, she said.
Of course, she had stripped off her shirt in the storm.
Shirt?
He asked, looking toward her shelter where he knew she kept another.
No. Lul.
She leaned forward enough that he could turn and look into her face. She slid one thin hand around the inside of his arm, pushing until she was fully entwined with his. She rested her chin on his shoulder and pressed her forehead into the thin hair at his temple. He could feel and hear her breath in his ear.
Lul is okay. Lul is...
With her free hand, she flicked at the corner of the light screen, spinning it around to adjust to her new position. Her hand hovered over the buttons until she found what she wanted, looking to make sure Lul could see too.
Lul is safe. Meg is safe.
Meg. She was freezing, but that wasn't why she climbed over to Lul's side of the table. She slithered out and under the table because she couldn't take another minute of listening to the low pitch and roll of his thrum, rising and dropping like a hummed sob in his throat. She'd never heard him make that sound, had never heard any of them make it, and it pushed into her heart like a nail until she had to move, had to do something to soothe it, to silence it. She didn't know if touching Lul would help or make him more uncomfortable. He was already unhappy with her, that she knew, but she was sorry and scared she would lose him. Her skin felt chafed and sore from the mudslides. She was hungry and cold, but most of all, she felt as if she had brutalized her new friend with her silence. If she couldn't explain with words, she'd explain with warmth, with sheer proximity. The rough cloth of his shirt scratched her skin, but she wrapped her arm around his anyway, resting her chin on his shoulder. She could see the dark skin beneath his ear flush darker when she breathed on it, and was thankful for Cho's warning. At the moment, she very much wanted to brush her lips against that dark, pulsing skin. It wasn't a sexual compulsion. It just seemed intimate. Instead, she leaned her head against his and assured him that he was safe. They were both safe. When Lul didn't pull away, she decided to try a new concept. Lul. Meg turned her head on his shoulder, her cheek near his, and looked down at the screen. The hand that didn't grip his arm swept away the red boxes in the middle of the screen, opening up a new empty box. She had a new word or concept she wanted to teach him. He waved his knuckles toward each other with a faint movement. A half-hearted yes. He also didn't want to accidentally yank her arm where it was wrapped around his. He could feel her fingers settle into his bicep, not squeezing but just taking their place, and he had to admit he liked the sensation. Meg's fingers flitted along the side of the screen, lines and symbols flying by in a blur. She flicked and pushed, shifting boxes within boxes, looking for something in what he understood to be the Urfer's database. It seemed to him to hold an enormous amount of data, and her fingers flew through the labels. She found what she wanted, drawing a data box onto the middle of the screen. A few more flicks and the box filled with other boxes. Photographs, Lul knew. The pictures were tiny, impossible to make out, but Meg seemed able to sort through them. They'd used photos before for simple vocabulary words, and Lul had always hoped she would show him more pictures of Earth. The picture she opened wasn't a photograph, but a graphic. Her language program had a lot of those, simplified images of basic objects. It made sense, although they'd both had a few laughs when what was a basic object to Meg had completely confounded Lul. This time, he knew what the picture was supposed to be, a man and a woman. It was funny to see the Urfer rendition of male and female, skinny and long like the Urfers themselves. A few more flicks of her finger and two smaller people appeared between the man and woman. Meg kept shifting through the data and pulled out what he recognized as audio commands, lining them up beneath the figures and pressing the buttons. Mother. Father. It was FN1's voice. Child. Children. Family. She must have recorded these words with Cho when discussing gender and reproduction. When Meg and Cho went into stasis, he spent most of his time with the Effins, listening to them gush about the information they were learning. This vocabulary had already been established. Why was Meg bringing it up now? She waved her hand over the image of the family. Lul family? Lul jerked away from her, not caring if he jerked her arm clean off her body. He pushed away, fear punching into his stomach as he scrabbled from the booth, putting the table between them. Meg's eyes were wide, her hands held palms up in what he knew meant no danger. He'd seen the Urfers use that posture before, usually when they'd startled someone on the worksite sneaking up behind them with that silent glide of theirs. His voice poured from her speaker patch in broken phrases, just pieces of,
Lul, no. Meg, no good. No, Meg. What this? No, Lul, move.
He swung his fists through the air, the sign to be quiet. He needed her to be quiet. He needed to not hear her words in his voice. She said nothing for several moments, letting him stand there and pound his fists into his hips, thinking. When she moved, it was with that very slow movement he knew they only used when they needed to make a point or when the work crews had been startled. He used to think the slow movement was soothing, a way to give the Didetto a chance to follow along. Now there seemed to be something dangerous in slow grace. Her hands floated over the light screen.
Lul? What?
Meg need want ask.
Family is no good?
He couldn't believe how still she could sit. He watched her, staring at her, not blinking and trying to wait her out, but he knew he couldn't. It was like they could turn to stone if they wanted. Lul unclenched his fists, trying to relax. He had a question he had to ask, and it scared him. The possibility scared him breathless, but the thought of not knowing scared him more.
How did you know?
This wasn't in their vocabulary. He knew that, but he had to ask the question anyway. Meg's head tilted just a fraction, an involuntary sign of confusion. She kept her eyes on him, even her blinks slow and controlled. She bobbed her head slightly, asking him to repeat. He leaned in toward the table. It was stupid, he knew, to have jerked away like that. If it was true, if she could read his mind, she'd have seen it coming. She would know what he was doing right now. She wouldn't have been confused by the question. The more he thought about it, the more absurd the idea became, but he had to ask anyway. He had to find a way to make her understand. He crouched beside the table. He wanted to sit back down, but he didn't really want to be sitting beside Meg when he asked the question, because for one thing, it hurt his neck trying to turn to see, and for another, if the answer turned out to be yes, he couldn't trust himself not to leap out of the booth again and look like an idiot. At the same time, he didn't want to sit on the other side of the booth because, well, Meg had climbed over to his side to be close to him. To purposefully move away from her, even after he'd just jumped away, seemed rude. Lul ground his teeth at his own absurdity.
Meg.
He gripped the table tight and saw her draw into herself, her shoulder carriage stiff in that way that meant she was not relaxed. She stared hard into his eyes, and he could just make out the edge of sharp white teeth biting her lower lip.
Lul need want no. Meg, Lul talks, yes?
She tapped the yes button, her lip whitening where her teeth pressed against it.
Lul talks and Meg,
He tapped his ear.
Meg hears, yes?
Yes. She spoke, her head tipping and bobbing forward, her neck looser now, telling Lul that she was really listening to him. When Meg listened, she listened with her whole body, which was part of the point of his question. He hit the question mark and tried to phrase the next part right.
Does Meg hear, Lul no talk?
She bobbed her head, and he repeated the nonsensical question. No sign that she got it. He crouched down closer to the table, getting more engrossed in communicating the concept than in his fear of the concept itself.
Let's try this,
he muttered. He looked at Meg. He pointed to his mouth.
Lul talks words, yes?
She tapped her knuckles.
There are words here.
He pointed to his mouth.
Yes, words here?
She tapped her knuckles again. Somewhere during his questions, they had come to lean in closer to each other. Lul watched her pupils widen as he tapped the side of his head.
And words here?
He tapped his skull.
Lul talks here, yes?
Her fingers slid near the yes button. She wanted him to continue to explain. He couldn't have stopped if he'd tried. His voice was thin and tense as he whispered his question to Meg.
Does Meg hear Lul talk words here?
He tapped his skull.
Does Meg hear words Lul talks here?
Her shoulders dropped and a soft breath blew from her open mouth. Meg's whole body collapsed into a relaxed slouch. Lul knew this meant she had understood him. What he didn't know was what her answer was going to be. He didn't know how she would react to it. She laughed. She laughed a breathy laugh that turned into a choppy laugh. Her head fell back, showing all her teeth, and her flat palms smacked together in a loud slap. Of all the reactions he'd expected, this wasn't one of them. She covered her wide-opened mouth with her fingers and kept laughing long enough for him to wonder if she was laughing at him rather than in relief at understanding him. No sooner had the thought crossed his mind than she reached for him, wrapping her fingers around his hands where they clutched the table and leaning in close.
No, she said through a smile.
Meg no hear words here. Her fingers brushed the side of his head.
Lul hear Meg talk here?
No,
he said.
Of course not. But how do you know? How?
He pressed the question mark again, then touched his head.
Lul talked here about family and Meg asks family. Lul is not okay and Meg asks why Lul is not okay. How? Meg hears words, yes?
No, Meg hears...
She bit her lip again, her hand hovering near his face. Her fingers trembled, hesitating.
Meg hears this.
And very softly she slid her fingers across his rose spot. Meg. She remembers a dance at Queen of Heaven School. She and her sister, Maddie, were in C school, so they couldn't have been more than 12 or 13 years old. It was their first real dance, with boys and shadows and slow dancing. Clayton Harvey had asked her to dance just like Maddie said he would. Maddie said Clayton had a crush on her, and while it had been almost impossible to believe, Clayton Harvey being Clayton Harvey, Meg had believed her. Meg always believed Maddie because even though they were twins and did almost everything together, Maddie always seemed to know so much more than Meg. She made it through the first dance without throwing up on herself or tripping, and then, unbelievably, Clayton Harvey asked her to keep on dancing with him. And it was a slow song, a really slow song, Cries in the Dark, which everyone knew was a super sexy song, although Meg didn't really know what was so sexy about it. But when she wrapped her arms around Clayton Harvey's neck and he wrapped his arms around her waist, his hand coming really close to her butt, she started to get the appeal of the song. They danced the whole song like that, getting closer and closer, even though they were touching almost everywhere from shoulder to knee. And then she'd heard Clayton's breath catch and felt him go tense where he stood. And when she pulled her head back, she saw a look on Clayton Harvey's face that she would never forget. Especially since he dropped his arms and ran off the dance floor, leaving her standing there like a dork. Maddie had laughed and laughed, explaining to Meg in the bathroom what had happened, and for the countless time Meg had wondered how her twin knew these kinds of things. She wondered why, if it had felt so good to him, had he looked so terrified. Of course, that was a lot of years ago, and Meg had eventually caught up to her sister in such matters, but she still keenly remembered that wide-eyed look on Clayton Harvey's face during that first slow dance. All these years later, she was seeing it again. Lul didn't have Clayton Harvey's apple cheeks or baby blue eyes, and he probably wasn't about to go off in his pants, but Meg knew that look. She was still able to draw that look from Cho on the rare occasions they had the opportunity to get a little adventurous. She knew, or at least she hoped, Lul wouldn't act on the gesture, since from what Cho had told her, the logistics would be awkward at best. But Lul had asked where she heard his thoughts. He wanted to know how she gauged his feelings. She had lied to him enough. For this, she would tell him the truth. She drew her hand away from the pulse point, hearing his thrum stutter in surprise, then settle into a steady yet higher pitch. She sat back down in her seat, tucking her hands under the table in hopes that if they were out of sight, it would somehow lessen whatever embarrassment Lul might be feeling. She didn't know what embarrassment looked like on him. She wasn't sure if she'd seen it yet. She'd seen surprise and bewilderment and anger, but if he'd ever been embarrassed around her, he'd hidden it. He was hiding it now, unless it looked a lot like happy wonder. Lul climbed back into the booth beside her, turning his body so his back was to the small dividing wall and he could face her more easily. He put his finger against the dark pulse point, and for one awkward second, Meg didn't know if it was her turn to be embarrassed.
Meg hears words here?
Apparently they were going forward. Good. No words. Meg hears.
What hears?
How could she describe it? She couldn't make that sound in her own throat. The closest she could come was a hum, a deep vibrating hum, like the kind the therapist had taught her to make for meditation. She knew Lul could hear the sound in his earpiece, and she raised the tone, humming a tune she thought might be Mozart. She hummed until her throat started to itch. Then she opened her mouth and la-la-la'd a few notes. She was way off the real sound of the thrums, but something in the music came closer to explaining it.
This Meg hears? This Lul Meg hears?
Yes. Lul is okay. She hummed low and even. Lul is not okay. She raised the pitch, letting her throat choke the sounds to a stutter. Lul's mouth hung slightly open, his thrum soft and even. He brought his hands up between them.
Meg is okay. Lul.
His hands hung in the air like he'd forgotten how to use them. He shifted, rocking on his thick legs until he leaned toward the table, still facing her. Lul? Yes? His right hand reached out slowly toward her face, and his teeth ground together.
Is okay, Lul, here?
His hand came close to her jaw. Meg smiled, tilting her head to the side, exposing the soft skin beneath her ear to him. She turned a bit, showing the pale expanse of her neck. Touch? She drew his hand and put it to her own pulse point, wondering if he could feel the faint movement there. She felt the tender pads of his fingers open against her skin, could feel the warmth where the rougher skin parted. A small part of her worried they were crossing some line of propriety, but as always, she went with her gut, not her rule book. Yes? Talk this. She put her hand over his on her throat. Pro Ling Lang captured his word for the pulse point, which she labeled the thrum spot since the Didetto had other pulse points that didn't make any noise and weren't darker in tone. Cho had declared the spot sexual in nature, an erogenous zone, but sitting here with Lul, his tender fingertips on her throat, having been forgiven for lying and scaring him near to death, she thought maybe there was more to it. Lul. Under the sensitive skin of his finger pads, Lul could feel the blood rushing beneath Meg's skin. He could feel how soft the tissue was there, and he thought her slender neck might be even more fragile than it looked. But she didn't flinch or tense as his thick fingers rested against the warm skin. He felt the muscles flex as she breathed and swallowed, her eyes closing slightly at his touch. The Effens had discussed the absence of the rose spot, speculating that perhaps it was simply a pigmentation issue. The range of colors of the Urfers varied so much, from the very pale Praetor to the very dark Agnar. Cho's mid-tone skin bore darker-than-black symbols. Meg and Chefson both had spots of color sprinkled across their skin, although none of the colored patches were large enough or showed any sensitivity to serve as a rose spot. Meg relaxed into his touch, but somehow it felt different from the Didetto way. Maybe she didn't know enough to really relax into the touch, and maybe Urfers only responded when they were in their stasis mode. The Effens had let Lul watch Meg and Cho when they were in stasis, their bodies alternating between limp and active, responding to stimuli the scientists couldn't explain. Maybe their rose spot rested somewhere else on their bodies. Maybe they didn't have one at all. Grandma Bo used to tell him stories about the old sea gods who didn't have rose spots. She would gather all the kids around the shucking pit, keeping them captivated with her stories so they would keep shucking the Mogi and Ketso and stay out of their parents' hair. In her stories, the sea gods rose out of the water and left enormous footprints all across Didet, needing to keep their feet from getting muddy. She said the sea gods had come from the center of the planet, and because they could breathe underwater, where sound travels faster than on land, they could speak in the slightest whispers. According to Grandma Bo, the people on the land couldn't hear them when they spoke, so the sea gods put magical shells just below the people's ears. The shells dissolved, leaving the rose spot. And after the sea gods went back to the center of the planet, the people forgot how to hear with the rose spot, but they never forgot what it felt like to hear the gods. "That's why only the most important people, only the people you truly love," she would say, brushing her fingers across each of their young necks, "can make your rose spot blush." Lul pulled his finger away from Meg's neck, smiling when he saw the flush of color where his fingertips had been. Chapter 13. Meg. Meg and Lul were still smiling at each other when Wagner started to shout. He and Olam, the leader of the Didetto work team, both fell back from their table where wires and screens and plugs and clamps teetered in a mess nobody dared approach. Olam and his crew shimmied and jumped, bumping into each other as Wagner held his hands high in the air, bellowing a wordless cry. Everyone spun toward the scene, not knowing if the news was good or bad. Jefferson swore, then Cho, and when Meg looked down, she saw her light screen had gone black, her wristband flashing in warning. "Hey!" she shouted at Wagner, who ignored her. "What did you do?" Lul rose from the booth, trying to see what the ruckus was over the heaps of equipment. On the far side of the site, Praetor threw down a wrench, nearly taking Kick out at the knee, and she stalked toward the captain. Before anyone could reach them, Wagner, Olam, and two others in the crew body-slammed into each other, chests first. Unfortunately for Wagner, his chest was a great deal higher than the crew's, and he took the brunt of the thrust in the gut. They also outweighed him, and in seconds the captain disappeared under a huddle of muscular, grunting bodies. Jefferson and Praetor were first to reach the pile, stopping just short of throwing fists when they heard Wagner laughing.
"We did it!"
His breath caught as another shoulder hit his gut, but he wheezed out another laugh.
"We did it!"
Olam and crew pounded the ground around them, rolling off of the captain when they realized the damage they were doing. Olam's second, a gray-haired woman with faded black bands across her fingers, started a 2-2-1 beat on the ground that the rest of the team quickly picked up. Wagner laughed, catching his breath, and then joined them in hammering his fists against the ground. Cho, with the effins in tow, sidled up to the edge of Meg's booth.
He crashed our computer system? Yippee. Maybe Prater can blow a hole in the fuel cell and we can make a party out of it.
Meg laughed, craning her neck to watch the captain and Olam pounding the ground, grinning at each other. When the captain threw back his head and let out another one of his unmistakable bellowing laughs, Olam reached forward and cupped his hand around the captain's neck, just under his ear. The captain responded in kind, bringing his hand up and clutching the man at the neck, his long, dark fingers covering Olam's flushed thrumming spot. She heard Cho make a little sound of warning, but put her hand out to stop him.
I don't think it means what you think it means. I think there's more to it.
Unless Olam and Wagner had secretly become lovers at some point, Meg seemed to be right. The two men grinned at each other, pulling each other in until their foreheads bumped. Around them, the work crew continued their rhythmic pounding of the ground, crouching and rocking. It might have gone on for hours if an empty cable wheel hadn't sailed through the air and hit Wagner on the back. Prater saw her missile hit home.
You two want to take your makeout session somewhere else? I just lost my propulsion diagnostic.
Meg heard Cho mutter something about a psychopath as Wagner and Olam rose to their feet, their grins not diminished a whit.
For your information, Officer Prater, you have lost exactly shit. Not only have you not lost your precious propulsion diagnostic, you have now gained the ability to run your data in two languages.
I can already run it in Mandarin, Prater said.
Wagner looked heavenward, shaking his head.
Reboot your screens, all of you.
Meg reset her wristband, and when the light flashed, she pulled the light screen across the table. It flickered, taking longer than usual to reset, but when it did, she heard Lul's thrum rise. The text boxes came to life across the screen, the words and questions and syntax grouping where she had left them. Only now, beneath each text box, another blue box appeared with groupings of dots and lines she couldn't decipher. She couldn't decipher them, but Lul could. He leaned over the table, pushing back into the booth to sit beside her, his hands hovering over the screen as he hummed to himself.
Lul talked to Meg.
It took her a second to realize that he hadn't spoken. Instead, he had pressed the correct buttons on the light screen to activate the recorded audio.
Lul has words for Meg. Lul has words. Here.
He grinned at her.
Here.
His finger jabbed the word button for here as he laughed.
You can read this?
Meg asked, knowing they didn't have the word for read yet, but Lul knew what she was saying. Wagner and Olam had found a way to interface the two disparate computer systems. Lul and the rest of the work crews would be able to read the data the Earthers worked with. They would be able to share the information both sides so desperately wanted to share. This changed everything. It didn't change everything perfectly. Glitches and miscommunications still riddled the interface. Didedo expression of chemical compounds differed significantly from Earther science, and Cho and Jefferson teamed up to work with their respective teams. Whether a biologist or a geologist, chemicals were chemicals, and together the teams made more headway than alone. The breakthrough in the sharing of navigational charts caused what could only be called a ruckus among Wagner's team. Dozens of officials being called in to handle the flood of data the Space Administration officials had never dreamed of seeing in their lifetimes. Prater and Kick and company didn't see too much of a difference, Prater concentrating more on teaching Kick to weld the polymer compound around the thrusters than teaching him the physics of propulsion. It was Meg and Lul who hit the biggest stumbling blocks. The Didedo database contained a large number of words that the Earther computer stalled on, turned over, and inexplicably translated consistently as turkey. Meg suspected this was a deeply hidden joke put in place by the original programmers back when the idea of an interface this unusual was inconceivable. Like most of the technology, the language, and the sense of time the computer programming used throughout the terraforming ring and in deep space had all originated from Earth. It had all been designed to interface relatively easily with other systems. Like language itself, it all hailed from the same sensibility. Apparently, Didetto data storage didn't fall along those same lines, and more than once Meg had snorted at the computer's bizarre translation. Government based upon equal distribution of life resources, population safety, and social turkey, Meg read, laughing. Lul didn't know why this important line from the Kartar Charter made her laugh until she explained the snafu. She brought up a picture of a turkey, one of the old huge-breasted white tom turkeys that had gone extinct in the late 22nd century, because the absurdity of the bird perfectly captured the essence of the translation. Lul laughed too, and they kept the bird in the center of the light screen. Every time it came up, Meg tapped it, activating the audio commands so the gobble-gobble-gobble sound did the talking for her. Lul. The interface changed everything. When Lul saw the script filling in the boxes beneath the Urfer symbols, he almost flipped the table in his joy. He drummed his hands, watching as words populated the screen, filling in the audio prompts Meg and the Urfers had recorded. Olam kept shouting something about a sound mirror, and Lul could only assume that he and Agnar had found a way to let the computers listen to each other. It was all beyond him. He'd never been much of a computer guy, even though he spent the majority of his workday tethered to one. At least he used to. With the screen labeled in Kartar, Lul was able to phrase questions differently and flesh out the broken phrases he and Meg had been using. Vocabulary lists tripled and then tripled again and again as images met their equivalents in the communicating databases. Lul had no idea what that fat white monstrosity was in the center of the screen. Some sort of comic book animal? But for some reason it kept popping up, making Meg laugh. They had been way off in some of the assumptions. Those strings the Urfers sometimes ran through their mouths weren't any type of feeding or relaxation method. It seemed the tut sometimes left fragments of fiber between their glassy teeth, and those teeth were sensitive enough that the sensation drove the Urfers to distraction. And the small packets of gel they rubbed on their skin weren't to protect against the sun or wind, as the Effens first suspected, but to heal the small breaks in their skin where even small rocks thrown by the wind would cut them. It seemed the skin all over their bodies was as sensitive as the tenderest skin in Lul's finger pads. They also had a complicated sense of humor, the tempo of which changed depending on who was teasing whom. As the vocabulary screen filled itself in with Lul's language, he started making sense of the low phrases Cho often muttered to himself or to Meg, usually when the smallest Urfer, Praetor, was making one of her large gestures. The computer didn't translate all the words, but Lul began to get a sense that the further from the truth Cho spoke and the flatter he kept his tone, the more Meg laughed. In a way, Cho's soft-spoken commentary reminded Lul of Hark and his knife-like friendly teasing. Numbers self-populated in the database as well. Meg and Lul didn't deal much with numbers in their conversations, although it was nice to have the means to discuss sequences and preferences. First and last and next and later followed naturally from the language of numbers, and soon both of them ignored the number bar scrolling along the bottom of the screen. Meg let the ever-emerging text boxes move over them, sliding them into bundles that now made sense to Lul. But there was one box of numbers she never covered. She never referred or pointed to it, but very casually made a point of always keeping it mostly uncovered. Before he'd known the number system, he'd assumed the flashing symbols were some sort of data counter like the kind used in telemetry, a marker of sorts for tracking research. Once the small box of Kartar writing appeared under it, however, he saw the box was indeed a counter, only those numbers were going down, steadily decreasing and heading toward zero. A countdown. Meg. She wound up sleeping with Prater after Kick swung the welding arc and burned Prater's hand too badly to be ignored. All the excitement of the communication and data breakthrough had made the engineer jittery, and Prater had sworn like it was her job when the blue arc whipped across the back of her wrist. The injury wasn't too serious. She didn't need surgery, and she wasn't in any grave danger. However, the ply patch needed to cover the area and regrow the skin, which required her to keep her hand immobile for at least 6 hours. Cho declared that the only way Prater could remain immobile for 6 hours was to either tie her down or tranquilize her. With as straight a face as she could muster, Meg suggested that the tying down option was too difficult to explain culturally. And so Prater and Cho had swapped sleeping shifts. Cho wanted to keep an eye on the ply patch while Prater slept, not trusting the restless engineer to be still enough even while unconscious, and Meg had bitten back her laugh watching Cho wrestle with the logistics. Meg needed sleep. She was 2 hours behind her sleep time and could feel her brain getting foggy. Cho and the Effens worked close by the tent she and Cho shared. It made sense that Prater would swap out and sleep in the tent with her. The problem was she knew Cho was more than a little particular about things like tent sharing.
"Have you seen their sleep pad?"
he'd asked her one day after Jefferson and Prater had climbed out.
"It's like a gravel driveway. Do they even brush their hair? I mean, I don't want to fall back on any Galen colony stereotypes, but does Jefferson even own a brush? And when's the last time Prater washed that halter?"
Meg had laughed, letting Cho gripe. They all had their peculiarities. Now, however, that peculiarity was being tested as Prater climbed into the shelter beside her, flopping back on Cho's sleep pad without even kicking off her shoes. Her arm was splinted, the ply patch was securely taped down, and Cho tried not to look as a clatter of small pebbles poured from her pockets when she settled back. He gave her the sedative and crawled from the tent without a word.
"He's always such a crab," Prater said, shifting against the small pillow. "How can you stand him? Does he ever smile?"
"He smiles plenty."
"Yeah, I bet," she snorted. "Especially when you're in here, right? Well, just remember, I'm not him. Don't be rolling over into me copping a field tonight."
"I don't know, Prater," Meg said around a yawn. "You smell pretty manly."
"I do, don't I?"
She laughed, not sounding at all affected by the sedative. She draped her arm over her eye the same way Cho often did.
"I wish it would get dark. I miss it being dark."
Meg closed her eyes.
"Me too.
I can't understand how it is we have the technology to travel across space, and yet nobody has been able to design a pair of eye shades that actually stay on while you sleep."
"Tell me about it." "Ow, shit. My hand hurts. That freaking kick."
"Keep it still. If you bend the patch, it won't bond."
"I know, I know, I know."
Prater sighed, fidgeting and kicking her feet against the edge of the sleep pad. Meg almost told her to knock it off, but there was something nice about her restlessness. The high pitch of her sighs and impatient sounds reminded Meg of sharing a bed all those years ago with Maddie. Her twin had never been able to just let go like Meg could, and instead fought sleep with the boundless energy that always gripped her. Prater flipped the sheet off of her legs, pointing her feet toward the ceiling of the low tent and softly tapped